The Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Ms. Sherrill, please call the roll.
Chair Plasencia.
Here.
Vice Chair Maney.
Here.
Representatives Casello.
Here.
Grieco.
Here.
Hawkins.
Here.
Maygard, excused. Mariano.
Here.
McCurdy.
Here.
Nixon. Rizzo.
Here.
Rodriguez, excused. Schoaf.
Here.
Ranking Member Thompson.
Here.
Tuck.
Here.
Zika.
Present.
We have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee. Please make sure that cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or on silent mode. Members, today we will hear a fiscal issue update by the Department of Education on the implementation of HB 1507 relating to workforce-related programs and services. Presenting today, we have Tara Goodman from the Florida Department of Education, Vice Chancellor of Career and Adult Education, Chancellor Kathy Hebda, Florida Department of Education, Chancellor for the Florida College System, and Carrie Henderson from the Florida Department of Education, Executive Vice Chancellor for the Florida College System. Chancellor Hebda, you are recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, Ranking Member, and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be with you today, along with my colleagues that the Chair just introduced, to present you an update on the implementation of House Bill 1507, or the REACH Act. Say that. This is why we have a different chancellor for career and technical education. Again, good morning, and pleased to do this for you. And this is the agenda we have for you this morning. As the chair mentioned, this is an update on the education portions that particularly pertain to funding and opportunities for funding under the REACH Act. You can see that we're going to do an overview of the act that pertains to education, and these are some of the featured programs you're going to hear more about. Both from Dr. Henderson and Vice Chancellor Goodman, who are leaders in these areas and working with all the other partners on implementation of these programs. I'd like to start with the purpose of the REACH Act. The legislature was very clear in the purpose in stating the implementation desires with the results of this act. It is a far-reaching act. It is a good name for it, it's the REACH Act, because it does really try to, as you can see, pull all of the partners together who are participating in workforce education and provide a structure and coordination so that every Floridian, wherever they live in Florida, has access to high-quality education. These are some of the important features of the Act that you will hear throughout the presentation today. It doesn't matter which program in the Act you're specifically talking about, these features will be prominent. The first one is the no wrong door entry strategy. As you saw earlier in the presentation of the purpose of the Act, this Act really seeks to provide access to all Floridians, to the workforce training they need. If you think about it, a long time ago when we were in elementary school, we used to hear our teachers say, lifelong learning is really important, and it sounded like a very sweet slogan, but that is the way people access education and training now on. There's no longer a way to get one degree, one credential, and that lasts you your whole life. We have to keep upskilling and retraining. And this act really understands that so that it provides access to all Floridians to that training. And you can see too, there's collaboration. It provides a structure for how different entities work together. It creates a couple of new stakeholder groups. It creates the Credential Review Committee. It also creates the Labor Market Estimating Conference. And then it discusses and provides a structure for how these entities work together, the products and policies they're accountable for, and then holds everybody accountable for making sure those things happen so Floridians have access to that high-quality training. And, of course, particularly important to this committee, as the chair mentioned, the opportunities for new funding streams, some really specific targeted funding streams, and also revises some of the current funding streams of the past and gives them a new definition. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'd love to call on Vice Chancellor Goodman to do the rest of, or the next part of the presentation.
little shorter. Thank you for the opportunity, Chair, Vice Chair, and Ranking Member, to present on one of the premier funding opportunities that we've had in the last few years to help support expansion of registered apprenticeship. I'm going to spend a little time reminding everyone about the Pathways to Career Opportunities Grant and giving you an update of where we are on implementation and funding for this opportunity. Apprenticeships have been in the spotlight at the federal level and at the state level for the last 3 or 4 years. And beginning in 2019-20, the legislature, this committee, helped shepherd bills that would support a new grant opportunity to support the expansion of registered apprenticeship. When Governor DeSantis came into office, one of his first actions was Executive Order 19-31, which explicitly included a request for $10 million and subsequently included in his governor's budget request to support registered apprenticeship. So we've had a couple of years now to fund some projects. I'm going to give you an update on these. In 1920, we were able to fund almost 50 proposals to expand both apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship opportunities for both creating new apprenticeship programs as well as expanding existing apprenticeship programs. We have a lot of strong existing partners in the state who provide registered apprenticeship, but we're also working to expand into some additional non-traditional areas for apprenticeship. Those grants have ended on June 30th, and we're beginning to evaluate the first-year outcomes for those. We are in the process of continuing grants that we funded in 2021. Because of the grant cycle, we extended their grant period another year because this body supported revert and reappropriate of those funds. Because the grants weren't awarded until partially through the year, we wanted to make sure these programs could be successful. So we funded, again, about 50 proposals with that $10 million plus the revert and reappropriate from the prior year to support apprenticeship, pre-apprenticeship. Overall, the breakdown of expansion has been about 60% in apprenticeship and about 40% in pre-apprenticeship and about 60% in expansion and about 40% for new programs. The initial outcomes that we're seeing are primarily going to be based on enrollment. We've shared what we have to date. One part of House Bill 1507 does have new reporting requirements that I'll talk a little bit about. We are in cycle for awarding for the 21-22 awards. We are competitively reviewing them as we speak, and we hope to be able to announce a prioritized funding list very soon. We do know, however, that we received $29 million in requests for a $10 million appropriation, so there will have to be choices made. We do provide, again, the opportunity for competition, so our goal is to select the best proposals. We also include some scoring criteria to make sure that regions are represented. We want to make sure that all the programs aren't just being clustered in the same region, so we want to make sure that all regions of the state have an opportunity to get some of these funds. So we do take that into consideration as we do our scoring process. In terms of the types of trades that we're talking about, traditionally, a lot of registered apprenticeship has been in what we would call the architecture and construction cluster. We have a lot of electricians, plumbing, HVAC, a lot of things that are critical to Florida and our workforce, if you've ever had to find a good plumber or a good electrician. But at the same time, we want to expand to some non-traditional areas. And House Bill 7071 a few years ago did that to allow us to start looking at healthcare, information technology. So in these rounds of funding, we are starting to see more of those proposals. To date, about 55% of the current proposals we could classify as architecture and construction, but we are seeing many more in other areas. We're seeing pharmacy technician, information technology. These tend to be perhaps shorter-term training programs. A lot of the traditional architecture and construction are 3 or 4 year programs. A lot of the healthcare and the IT tend to be 1 to 2 year programs so that we can see a quicker turnaround to getting individuals into the workforce at full wages and being able to supply our employers who need skilled workers in these areas. In terms of how many programs were funded in healthcare to date, we had about 10% of these proposals that you see were in healthcare, 15% were in manufacturing, 5% in information technology, and 6% in transportation, distribution, and logistics. And these are some of the areas that we want to continue to see expansion in, and we're excited to be looking at the new round of funding for these proposals. Just as an aside, the entities in the statute that can apply for these funds are any registered apprenticeship program, public high schools, school district career centers, charter technical career centers, and Florida college system institutions. We see a variety of proposals funded. We can certainly provide the committee with the full list if you're interested in seeing the full list. We did present in a substantive committee yesterday with that information, but we're happy to provide more detail if the committee needs it. In terms of this grant opportunity, House Bill 1507 did demand some additional reporting, which is great because it is very important for us to be accountable for these funds. So this law requires us to annually report on the number of programs funded and represented throughout the state, to report on retention, completion, and employment rates for both program and provider, as well as the starting and ending salaries for those participants in the program. For the initial funded projects, we're really looking at the first year, so we're focusing on enrollment. We're going to be defining via rule all of these standards for this. Retention is going to be, you know, our students who entering the program continuing in the program, and we're going to develop standard metrics for that for each, for accountability purposes, as well as are the students who are in the program completing the program. We also look at on-time completion in our annual apprenticeship report, which is an important consideration as well. Are people completing in a reasonable period of time? So we're initiating rulemaking, and we anticipate in the first quarter of next year probably having this rule implemented, and then we will begin publishing the information once we define all those things in consultation with all the providers. Another key area of House Bill 1507 focused on work-based learning. Apprenticeship is kind of the ultimate earn and learn model, but there are a lot of different ways to incorporate work-based skills in educational programs. And I think many of us can all agree we learned a lot of what we know today in our first job about how to interact, how to work with other people. And some of those soft skills, I think, are very critical to focus on in work-based learning opportunities, the kinds of things that we hear employers consistently say that they want to see. But it also gives the opportunity to see actually how it works on the job. You know, it's very theoretical when you're in the classroom, so it's really important for us to emphasize both paid and non-paid, but particularly paid experiences like apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship. This bill requires us to move forward with rulemaking on student eligibility, obligations of employers, and requirements for those institutions that offer work-based learning. For the first time, we do have a statutory definition of work-based learning opportunities to work off of, and that will guide this work. In a separate bill, an appropriation has been provided. It wasn't part of House Bill 1507, but it was in Senate Bill 366. It provides $2 million for reimbursement to employers, including school districts and colleges, for workers' compensation insurance premiums for students to participate in those opportunities. And as we've been working on this issue at the department the last few years, that's a common complaint that we have heard that is a barrier to participation is employers don't want to take the risk if they're not covered for an individual who might get harmed on their job site. So this is an opportunity for us to break down one of those barriers. Our Department of Finance and Operations is working on rulemaking associated with this appropriation. So we're excited to have these funds to help improve our work-based learning opportunities and provide compensation to those who are letting their students participate in these opportunities. I'm going to pivot now to another funding stream that is provided through this committee, which are performance incentive funds for industry certification attainment. Many of you may be aware of the Florida Career and Professional Education Act that was passed for K-12 purposes in 2007, but it was extended to post-secondary education in 2013. So beginning in the 2013-14 fiscal year, appropriations have been provided for both school district and Florida college system institutions whose students are earning qualified industry certifications that have been identified by the department. The department goes through a process to use the occupational areas specified in the General Appropriations Act and determine which industry certifications are critical for employment in those areas that are being offered by our school districts and Florida College System institutions. And we annually adopt a list that then becomes funding eligible with the appropriations provided. We have two sections of law, section 1011.80 and 1011.81, that provide the conditions for this. House Bill 1507 does make some amendments to that that I'll talk about in a moment, but under current law, it provides $1,000 per eligible certification contingent upon the appropriation level. In terms of the school district, they're in proviso currently, these occupational funding areas. They're very prescriptive. They're almost identical to the Florida College System, but there are a couple of minor differences in how they're expressed. Health sciences in the school district proviso is listed out all the occupations, whereas in the Florida College System, it just says health sciences. But these are the current occupational funding areas for 21-22. This chart shows the history of performance funding for the school district. You can see in beginning in 2013-14, we had $5 million, but there was only $1.5 million allocated for this purpose. And there was proviso that allowed the remainder to be allocated based on an older performance funding model if there had been any funds left over. But you can see since 2015-16, we've been in a proration situation almost every year where we were not able to provide $1,000 per certification as a result of the proration. You can see a dip in the most recent year of for the school districts of only $5,000 earned last fiscal year. That was largely as a result of most testing occurring at the end of the year and having access to testing during that last quarter of the 2019-20 year was difficult. You will note there is a gap year here between 2016-17 and 18-19. In the 2017-18 year, funding was not provided for school districts for industry certification attainment. There were other priority funding areas that those resources were used for, but it did resume in 2018-19. I'd like to note an important difference, though, is that unlike the school districts, unlike the Florida College System, the school districts now operate on a one-year lag for this performance funding. So, for example, the 2020-21 allocation is based on 2019-20 data. Prior to this jump, it was a current year funding situation. We would wait till the end of the year. Institutions report as much information as they could before June 1st, and then we would allocate the money. Within that gap year, the policy decision was made that the data might be more reliable if we just lag it a year, and that decision was made at that time to allow for that lag. The Florida College System does not operate with that lag currently. Some of the content areas that are most popular are healthcare, HVAC on the school district side, as well as law and public safety. We have a lot of law enforcement and correctional officers that have a required licensure that are included on this list. So those are some of the top areas. In terms of the Florida College System, this is nearly identical with the exception of the health sciences being expressed as a group and the addition of unmanned aircraft systems in the Florida College System funding areas. This chart shows the Florida College System performance funding history. It has a similar bent when it first started. As institutions became aware of what was on the list, they very quickly pivoted to being able to get their students earning those certifications and being funded for those. So the colleges have been in an extreme proration situation for many of these years until the appropriation started to rise. You can see it began at $5 million, then increased to $10 million, and then increased to $14 million in the most recent years. Again, for their allocation for 2020-2021, they had to prorate these. But they were based on activity through the end of the year. So again, it was 21-20 data that was used for the 2021 allocation, unlike for the school districts. Similarly, public safety and healthcare are a big part of the activity in these areas if you look at it by industry certification. The number one for colleges being the licensed registered nursing exam. So what House Bill 1507 does is force a little bit of a pivot. So this process that was used for the development of CAPE post-secondary industry certification was largely internal to the list provided by the legislature and the department identifying relevant industry certifications and adopting those in rule for those occupational areas. What this bill does is really, to Chancellor Hebda's point, house it in a credential review committee that has representation from a variety of areas throughout the state, including the department, but including lots of other types of institutions to represent business and industry, to represent private institutions. So this list that they are to develop is a list of all non-degree and degree credentials of value. So you'll hear that word a lot now, credentials of value. We abbreviate it to COV sometimes. But this list is to include all types of education credentials, including industry certifications and licensures. So essentially, what had been happening in the department will now move over time to the Credential Review Committee to be vetting and reviewing for occupational need. Where are the needs in Florida? And they will be determining the post-secondary funding eligibility through their process. This new list that's going to be developed is called the Master Credentials List, sometimes abbreviated MCL. For the startup of this bill, the Master Credential List is comprised of two lists that are currently adopted by the State Board of Education, the first of which is the CAPE Industry Certification Funding List, which is used for K-12 funding, and the CAPE Post-Secondary Industry Certification List that reflects the funding areas that I just mentioned. So that is the baseline list for the Master Credential List that we are working with. In terms of where we move forward, the charge has been given in this bill in 2223 to have a Master Credential List developed by the Credential Review Committee. There have been a lot of coordination, as Chancellor Hebda mentioned, with a variety of partners, our Education Governor's Office and workforce partners at DEO and CareerSource, to determine what building blocks are necessary in order for us to have this list. We're working on a variety of projects, including an updated classification of instructional programs, SIP, to standard occupational code, SOC, crosswalk, so that we can link our education data to occupations. So we often abbreviate that SIP to SOC. If you ever hear us use those acronyms, that's what we're talking about. But we're linking a program to a job, basically. These are different constructs, and all of our employment data is expressed by the SOC code, and all of our education data is represented by the CIP code. The Master Credential List, we're going to be using a lot of supply-demand analysis to help inform that and working with those partners, and it allows us to triangulate that Master Credential List to have program performance metrics associated. But I believe the intent of this law is really to focus on what really is going to help our employers and our Floridians to get better jobs. What skills do they need? What credentials do they need to have? And how do they need to be aligned? And where are we under and oversupplied so that we can address resources where we most need them? And so we're doing a lot of work, and it's an exciting time to be in this because there's a lot of change that's happening that we think will be good. In terms of how this affects this committee and your appropriation, is part of House Bill 1507 was to move away from this $1,000 per industry certification model and really determine a relative value. Because right now, with everything prorated, I have an individual who earns a registered nursing credential that took a two-year degree that gets the exact same amount as a credential that might have taken a quarter of that time or half of that time. So there's really no recognition of what the return on investment is from those credentials. And the goal of this change is to recognize the fact that not all credentials are created equally, and we want to right-size the incentive to where the return on investment is going to be. So this focus on job placement and wages is really critical because we want to incentivize the most valuable credentials. One-third of the funds are supposed to be allocated based on student job placement, and the remaining two-thirds are allocated based on a weighted system using student wages that exceed the minimum wage, with the highest weight applied to the highest wage tier and additional weights for underserved populations, which I think is important because it's important to recognize that sometimes performance funding can have equity gaps that result from that. So this was important language to include in this bill. So that process is underway currently. There's a lot of things that are happening with the Credential Review Committee, with the credentials of value, creating the framework of quality for that. And we believe that at the end of the day, we're going to end up with a more refined system for allocating these resources in a way that reflects their impact on our state and our workforce. I'm now going to turn it over to Dr. Henderson to talk about another funding opportunity, the Open Door Grant Program.
Good morning, everyone. So for the next few minutes, I'm going to guide you through an overview of the Open Door Grant Program, which was designed to incentivize institutions to create new or expand existing opportunities for students to enroll in short-term career and technical education programs. Part of the goal of Open Door was to expand the affordability of these short-term CTE programs and incentivize either current workers who are looking to upskill or workers who are unemployed, underemployed, or furloughed to seek an additional credential that is stackable, but that will result in positive outcomes for job placement for them. So this is a diagram, a decision tree, if you will, that provides institutions a way to understand the Open Door program from an implementation perspective. House Bill 1507 created two different types of programs that were subsequently approved by the State Board of Education and Rule, and we refer to those programs. One is the Last Dollar Program, and the second is the Student Investment Program. What's important to note is the determination of student eligibility for either of those programs is based on whether or not the student is already in receipt of state or federal financial aid. The Last Dollar Program is intended to provide whatever is needed, the unmet need on the student's account, for those students who are currently in receipt of state or federal aid. So I'm going to walk us through the top of the decision tree and start with the Last Dollar approach. So if a student enters an eligible program at an eligible institution, the institution would look at the student's record by looking at what they received on the FAFSA, as well as any other type of financial aid that they receive, and determine if the student is in receipt of state or federal aid. And if they are, the student would be admitted to the program, and if once they enroll in the program, the institution would first start by applying all of the student's current financial aid to the student's account. So if it's a $1,000 charge for a semester and the student has $700 in account balances, the Open Door grant would be applied for that last $300 in the cost of attendance. And so that's the portion that relates to the Last Dollar approach. The student investment approach is intended to capture students who are either in programs that are not eligible for federal financial aid, so a lot of our non-credit programs fall into that category, or there are many cases where a student may not be eligible for state or federal financial aid. And so the student investment approach is a way that the student and the institution both have skin in the game. So in the student investment approach, when a student enters the program, the student would pay one-third of the cost of the program upon entry, and all of those students would sign a contract with the institution indicating that they intend to complete the program within 12 months. And the goal there is for the student to understand and demonstrate a commitment to completing their degree. And it also incentivizes the institution to guide students toward degree completion. Part of that initial contract is if the student stops out or drops out, the student would be responsible for paying the institution back one-third of the cost of the program for non-completion. In the event where a student completes a program, there's two types of programs that we have. There are programs where the student earns a college-issued credential, a career certificate or a college credit certificate, and then the student sits for a third-party industry certification that would be on the master credential list or the CAPE funding list. So in those situations, the institution will receive a third of the funds once a student completes the college credential, and then the institution will receive the final one-third of the funds once the student successfully passes the associated certification. So again, the goal is to incentivize institutions to mentor students and ensure that they are completing and prepared to enter into the workforce. For this first year, because the CAPE funding list is the master credential list, all of our programs lead to a certification. It's possible, though, in the future, as the master credential list grows, that we may have programs where the only credential is that college credential. And so in that case, when a student completes the program, the institution would be eligible to receive two-thirds of the cost of the program. I do want to note one feature of the student investment approach, and that relates to what we call IET, or Integrated Education and Training Programs. Those are designed for students who do not yet have a high school diploma or its equivalent, and are working on those skills simultaneous to being enrolled in technical instruction that will result in the attainment of a credential of value. For that population, for those students, the students in IET programs can have their one-third covered using the Open Door Grant Program. So that provides an opportunity for them to have the ability to earn both the high school diploma or its equivalent alongside a credential of value. So that's an overview of the grant program as it exists. And now I'll get into a little more of the details around funding and eligibility. So to support the implementation of the Open Door Grant Program, the legislature appropriated a total of $35 million. $15 million was appropriated for school district career centers or technical colleges, and $20 million was allocated for Florida College System institutions. One of the things that the Open Door funding did is it prioritized rural institutions, and it also prioritized institutions offering those integrated education and training programs. Another really important facet is it's an open door program, and it's first come, first serve. So the goal is to incentivize institutions to create or expand these programs, and in the order in which we receive applications, we will make allocation decisions. So for that reason, no more than 25% of the funds can go to any single institution, and we will be allocating, as I said, on a first-come, first-serve basis. On the school district career center side, we have 31 districts that are eligible, and there are multiple, in some cases, multiple technical colleges within a single district. And then on the Florida College System side, we have 28 institutions that are eligible. So some key dates related to implementation. The budget program and performance period is July 1, 2021, so the date 1507 went into effect. So we are allowing pre-award costs for this grant under certain conditions. And the funds are set to be spent by September 30th of 2023. So the grants that institutions are currently in the process of writing will be around for more than a year. So the applications will cover through the end of the program performance period. As I said, the State Board of Education approved a new rule to implement this grant program. It's Rule 6A20.045, and it built on the language in 1507 and provided some additional information about how the allocations will be made and some of the institutional reporting requirements. September 15th was the date the department released the request for application to all of the eligible institutions. And I want to note here another critical opportunity that institutions have through local workforce development boards is the Get There Faster grants for underserved populations. And so those are grants that are designed to be awarded to local workforce development boards, but in partnership with local post-secondary institutions. And so to the extent that we can, we have encouraged institutions to consider how they might braid those funding sources to maximize the effect for students. October 15th, so right around the corner, is the first deadline to submit a completed application. So it is first come, first serve, and so we have already received applications. We established two review periods, and that just helps us when determining the allocation. So we are looking forward to reviewing the applications we receive by October 15th, and then the final deadline that institutions have is November 1st to submit a completed application to be considered for an open door grant program. In terms of how we're planning on making the allocations, as I mentioned, IET programs must be prioritized. And so as we review each agency application, we will look for inclusion of those IET programs and prioritize funding for them. Another big component, as I mentioned earlier, is 25% of the funds are earmarked for rural institutions. And so we've set a priority date for rural institutions to apply by October 15th. And our goal would be to the extent that funds are available and the applications are complete, we would fully fund those programs up to or exceeding 25%, depending on what we receive. And as I mentioned earlier, no single institution can receive more than 25% of funds. So that is the high-level overview of the Open Door Grant Program. I'm going to pivot now to the Money Back Guarantee Program. So this is not a funding opportunity necessarily for institutions, but rather it's a provision that has institutions really create and identify programs that they are confident in that are linked to credentials of value for the purpose of saying, we are so confident that our program is going to prepare students for job placement that if the student isn't able to obtain a job, we would give them their money back for whatever the student paid. So that's why it's known as the Money Back Guarantee Program. One of the key goals of the Florida College System and the technical colleges are to respond to community needs for workforce education and help individuals obtain employment. And so this is a way to stand behind that goal. And so the time period that institutions have, and I'll go into a little more detail about it, but it's a six-month time period. Once a student completes, if they obtain a job, the mission of the institution is fulfilled. But if students are unable to obtain employment, the institution would be responsible for refunding those dollars. So there are two different types of considerations related to identifying what programs qualify for Money Back Guarantee. I believe Chancellor Hebda mentioned earlier the Labor Market Estimating Conference, a new entity that was created through 1507, is creating a statewide needs list, looking at supply and demand, and looking at areas where there are increased demand for specific occupations and occupations that lead to middle to high wages. And so based on the Labor Market Estimating Conference's statewide needs list, institutions will need to evaluate all of their programs that are linked to occupations on that statewide needs list. And every institution essentially has to offer at least three programs with a money back guarantee for all of the programs that are linked to occupations on that statewide needs list. If a institution has programs that are not on the statewide needs list, so programs that don't have demonstrated demand, that don't have leading to middle to high wages, all of those programs would be required to be offered with a money back guarantee, with the intent of incentivizing institutions to be offering programs that do result in positive outcomes for students. As with many money back guarantees, there's always a fine print. And so the big area that institutions will be working on is determining what the eligibility criteria are for the money-back guarantee and how institutions and how the students would go about obtaining it. So 1507 identified the areas that you see on your screen as components of an institutional policy around the money-back guarantee. So institutions can require student attendance. They can look at student performance in a program. So how did the students do in coursework? What was their GPA? That type of thing. One of the big areas is looking at participation in career services activities. So making sure that students are exposed to employers through those types of opportunities, as well as participation in an internship and work-based learning program. Another big area would be job search documentation. So there is that six-month period that a student has to search for a job. The institution can establish parameters around how many jobs the student applies for and what documents the student would need to present to be eligible for the money-back guarantee. And then the last piece would be the development of a career plan with a student. So the student can identify all of their opportunities now that they've earned the credential and perhaps even set long-term goals to continue to obtain stackable credentials to lead them to whatever their ultimate goal would be. In terms of some key dates, the Money Back Guarantee Program will start for FCS institutions and school districts in the 22-23 academic year, so beginning in fall of 2022. By July 1 of 2022, all of the institutions must notify the State Board of Education about the Money Back Guarantee programs that they will offer at their institutions, and they will be required to include information about those programs on their websites, make the information available to students about what programs are eligible for the Money Back Guarantee, the conditions that students would have to meet to be eligible as well. And then annually, by November 1st, the department will report performance funding to the governor, the House, and the Senate to keep track of the effects of the Money Back Guarantee program, how many students obtained jobs, how many students were unemployed, and did they receive the Money Back Guarantee. So I believe that concludes the prepared portion of our questions or our presentation, and we're happy to answer questions now.
Members, are there any questions? Representative Schell, if you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that presentation. All of these programs are amazing. On programs like Open Door, how are you ensuring that parents and students are aware of these opportunities? Are we depending on the guidance counselors, or are we going out into the schools and making sure that everyone knows about them?
Sure. So a component of the Open Door Grant program, one of the student eligibility requirements is that a student, to be eligible, has to be unemployed, underemployed, or furloughed. And so when we think about that population, a lot of the work that will happen, certainly making the information available to parents and students, but also looking at partnerships with local workforce development boards, as well as other resources in the community where job seekers are looking for an opportunity to upskill. So I think the focus on the community, meeting people where they are and making sure that they're aware of those, is incredibly important.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other question. You mentioned lag funding and the differences between colleges and our high schools. Why are the colleges treated differently with that lag funding?
Sure. That's a good question. And I think what I would note about the industry certification funding on the FCS side, we do have a process of reconciliation. So for us, we made the decision to keep it current and recognize industry certifications for the current year. At the end of the year, May, June, we ask institutions to report certifications up for funding, but we also allow them the next reporting cycle to let us know if they missed anything on the reporting side, and they have the ability to have funds delivered at that point in time. So there is a process on our end for us to reconcile any changes within reporting to make sure that institutions have access to those funds.
Follow up on that. Have you found that, I mean, a simple gas guy, it seems to me that the high schools often have less resources to float that for a year than a college would. Mm-hmm. Are you getting any feedback from the high schools that they're struggling funding that for the year?
Sure. I may defer to Vice Chancellor Goodman for that one.
Thank you, Representative Shove. The high schools are in performance world are used to lag funding, so I think they build it in. I think when we did not have K-12 performance funding to begin with, it may have been more of a problem. Vice Chancellor Henderson's point, our goal is to ensure that all certifications are funded. And on the school district side, what we do is we try and make sure for the post-secondary list to get those resources out early in the year, so there's not really that big of a gap in funding. So for example, for activity that was reported through the end of the year, which was August for a school district post-secondary, we're gonna be rolling out those funds the first part of November, half of the funds then and half of the funds when the remaining funds are released to the department. So we are able to get the resources with as little gap as possible. On the college side, they do it one time a year at the end of the year. And it is slightly more real time, but we do what we can to get the resources out there as quickly as possible.
Thank you. At the end, if you have any extra time, I did have another one.
Members, any other questions? I have a couple questions, but I want to give Representative Shove the opportunity to continue his line of questioning right now. You're recognized, Representative Shove.
Thank you. I didn't mean to make this the show, but on the Pathway to Career Grant program, we know it's $10 million. Have you, my first question was, is it enough? But I know that that's a kind of an open-ended, silly question. Specifically, have you looked at, say, if we added, what impact an additional $1 million, what would that have on closing the skills gap in fields like electrician and plumbers, or $2 million? Do we know that?
Thank you, Representative Shove. We evaluate that on an ongoing basis. There is a cutoff for scoring in the competitive review process, and we never want to go beyond that because sometimes people, maybe their proposals need a little work before we're willing to fund them. So we have, for the most part, been able to fund almost every proposal to that cutoff to date. This year, I think it's going to look a little bit different because of the number of proposals that we received as well as the value of those. So we will evaluate that and use that in follow-up conversations. I think it will be instructive to see how many of these projects this year met the cutoff because we received a lot from business and industry this year, which was unusual. In the past, we've received a lot of the proposals from school districts and Florida College System institutions. This year, it flipped a little bit. I think about 60% of the proposals received were actually from the employer sponsor or the group sponsor. And so we want to make sure, to your point, that we are funding all quality proposals to the best of our ability.
Thank you. And I do have a question, and it falls in line with the questioning of Representative Shove. I've seen a lot of the marketing on the Get There program, which has been incredible. I guess my only concern is that, I tend to run in the same circles as Chancellor Mack and the Department of Education, so I kind of see it everywhere I turn. My question is, has there been a concerted effort on that program and on the Open Door Guarantee program to reach out to grassroots nonprofits, community nonprofits who have wraparound services and or local churches who may have access to people who are in need?
Mr. Chair, if you can hear me, I'll start. There are definitely organizations that we partner with and colleges partner with, for sure. One is the Florida College Access Network, or FCAN, and they specifically work with students leaving high school and looking for their opportunities in post-secondary and helping them plan those opportunities. And so that is one area that we've been partnering with and the department has partnered with and has the college system as well to help make sure they understand the types of information they can be sharing in their local college access networks. And then I would also add that the college system institutions themselves do have partnerships with their local workforce boards. And so they have especially looked carefully at this in 1507, because 1507 talks a lot about, as I mentioned, the no wrong door mindset, so that whether a person goes to a career source board, a local work source board, goes to a college, goes to a university or a school district technical center, they have information there that can provide them anything they need, understand what the opportunities are there for them. I will also say that we've heard a lot of, and we've seen a lot of it on social media as well, back from colleges and technical centers as well, that it participated in the Get There campaign, and how much that has helped them use those resources to then make workforce a real live opportunity for Floridians who didn't realize that it was before. And so I think it's not the silver bullet, but having started that program that you mentioned that you see often when you go out there has really helped institutions capitalize on that and reach people in all areas of the state.
Thank you. Members, are there any more questions? Okay. Members, this concludes, I apologize. First of all, thank you for being here. As always, phenomenal job, great programs. You know, I've always been a fan of the job that your office does and the department does and the other chancellors of the Department of Education. I have also been exposed to FCAN and what they do. Still would like to see more of a concerted effort of going into communities. When we take a look at, you know, an initiative and a priority of both the Department of Education, the state of Florida, the Florida Chamber, as far as going into those underserved communities, those zip codes that are the poorest in our state, and making sure that they have the information and access to these programs are really important. And as someone who comes from one of those communities, I have seen a lack of information going into those communities. So that's something that I often advocate for and hope we see more of a filtration into those communities. But as always, wonderful job, and thank you for being here. Members, this concludes our committee agenda. Is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, Representative Schoaf moves we rise without objection. The meeting is adjourned.